Hey y'all, it's Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm a board-certified gynecologist, a clinical assistant professor of OBGYN at Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, and owner of a private practice for almost a decade that specializes in menopause and sexual medicine. I'm a South Asian American Muslim woman who is here to empower, educate, and help you advocate for health issues that have been stigmatized, shamed, and perhaps even prevented you from living your best life. I'm better than your best girlfriend and more open than most of your doctors. I'm here to educate so you can advocate. Welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Let's go. Hey, y'all. It's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Please join me over on Instagram. I'm also on YouTube for Gyno Girl TV. I'm currently working in the Ms. Medicine team of concierge doctors to convert my practice into a concierge practice. So you guys will hear those updates over on my Instagram as well as the newsletters that I'll be sending out soon. But I'm super excited to be able to give, you know, even more nuanced care and more time to my patients and to limit sort of the number of patients I'm seeing so that I can provide better care to a smaller group. So you guys are going to be hearing about that soon. But you guys asked for this, and I am responding. There has been a lot of talk around sleep disturbances. Sleep is always such a big topic in my office when it comes to my perimenopausal patients or postpartum patients or any of the patients that we see that have struggled from being high stress environments. You know, as a OBGYN and basically like a former obstetrician when I was in residency, when I was attending, delivering babies at night, working night shifts, I would say like my sleep debt is so huge because I've never recovered from the years of not sleeping and the toll it's put on my body. I feel like sleep and the periods of insomnia that I've experienced have been so, so prominent. And, you know, with perimenopause that I'm experiencing now, in middle of the night wake ups for urinating or, you know, just because I have 101 things I'm trying to think about because I'm stressed out or because I've been depressed from my mom's death. There's so many things that have really precluded me from getting good night's sleep. And I know it happens to all of my patients and I'm sure a lot of my listeners. So I really wanted to, once I met this amazing doctor who I'm going to introduce, you know, I was like, you have to come on my podcast and we have to do a quick, you know, every question that I get asked about sleep, I'm going to ask you. So today I have the amazing Dr. Andrea Matsumura. We just finished our discussion on everything you need to know about sleep. She is a sleep medicine specialist. She is the Sleep Goddess MD on Instagram. And she's so freaking knowledgeable, man. I mean, I just like, you know, I love talking to her. I feel like I just can't wait to have her back on the show. She attended medical school at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio and then moved to Portland, Oregon for her residency in internal medicine. And she was with Northwest Permanente for 13 years before she entered a fellowship in sleep medicine. She attended the Oregon Health and Science University as a fellow in sleep medicine. And she's currently a partner in the Oregon Clinic in Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Medicine after she finished her fellowship. She's really been a focus on women's health and women's sleep and women's midlife sleep. And so she is just a wonderful fund of knowledge. She's part of the Portland Menopause Collective, which is made up of four physicians of various specialties who seek to lead in advancing awareness, fostering inclusive dialogue, and providing high-quality evidence-based education for menopausal health. Dr. Aoife O'Sullivan, who I had on the podcast, is another member of that great collaborative. She's a strong contributor to the community as a physician, as a sleep expert, and she is part of the executive committee for the Oregon Medical Association, sits on the JEDI Committee for Justice, Equity, Diversity, Inclusion, whose goal is to review and guide the activities of the Oregon Medical Association. She's a distinguished member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine and a fellow as well. She is freaking awesome. Okay. So you guys are going to love this discussion and I've answered all your sleep questions, but probably not every single one of them, but came close. So enjoy this podcast with Dr. Andrea. You guys asked for it, and I'm bringing it to you. Like, you guys heard my intro. I'm super excited to have this amazing physician who was an expert in sleep medicine, the sleep goddess herself, Dr. Andrea Matsumura. Like, I don't like overnight.
I love it. Thank you. Thank you, Samina.
You get sleep and you get sleep.
Yes. Because it's part of that whole suffering syndrome, right? That we've all been told that we shouldn't get enough sleep. So yes, I'm a board certified sleep physician, and then kind of turned women's health specialist and, really focusing on menopause, perimenopause, and for some pregnancy as well, because
I need to hear all this.
Your sleep definitely changes during pregnancy as well.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to touch on all that because I have, listeners from all arenas. I mean, a lot of them are midlife, but I feel like I have a lot of, I deal with a lot of genital pelvic pain patients. And so they have their own sleep issues, and they're on all these medications, which I feel like we need to talk about. The meds used, we need to talk about what's good, what's not, and who deserves a sleep study, and maybe a little bit about obstructive sleep apnea, if you can throw it in there.
Yes, 100%.
But let's talk a little bit about your journey, because we were about to talk. I was like, let's just record this. Tell us the way that you kind of came into, because none of us, probably people graduating now will be able to go into menopause in this way. Most of us have come into it and really had to teach it to ourselves through the Menopause Society and other mechanisms, because we either had patients that were having the problem or we ourselves suffered and then we had to go figure it out ourselves, right? So, and it might be both, because for some of us it's both.
I think for me, definitely it was both. So, I started out as a general internal medicine doc, and then around 13 years into my career, I really needed to make a shift. And I went back to school to study sleep, did a fellowship in sleep medicine. And then, I started practicing with this big group, mostly guys. And so then I was the only woman available, right? So then all these women started to come and see me. And what I started to notice was this pattern of this, first of all, generally speaking, that biopsychosocial model, women are just conditioned to say that they should never get good sleep. So socially, we are told that we shouldn't get sleep because we're always taking care of somebody or we've had a past trauma. Psychologically, then there's a lot of general anxiety sometimes around our, depending on what's going on in your life. Also past trauma. I mean, 1 in 3 people will have some trauma. 1 in 3 women, rather, will have some sort of trauma. And then the medical, like we weren't even, included in studies until 1993.
I know.
Right? It's crazy. And so then we're kind of behind.
We won't be included anymore.
I know. Right? And so, we're just behind the eight ball and really understanding sleep, the physiology of sleep for women. And the stuff that's out there right now, the sleep gurus that are out there right now, outside of myself, have really simply talked about the general public and really haven't focused on women. So then I got into this space. Then I hit perimenopause, menopause. I have my own terrible menopause story, but fast forward to, I started to really incorporate that all into my work about 7 years ago. And so now I've really focused on menopause, perimenopause, pregnancy, just women's issues and sleep. So lots of women would come to me that are in my stage of life. I'm in my mid 50s. I would recognize that they needed hormone therapy. Many of those women would get on hormone therapy. And about half of them in my practice were still having trouble sleeping, even after all of the addition of hormone replacement, hormone therapy that they were receiving. So we still have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we always, there's plenty of women who wake up because of their hot flashes or are drenched in their sweat at night or, get up because they have to pee frequently. So there are these symptoms that we can kind of treat. And I feel like they're helpful. And I would say, probably what a third to a fourth of women when they take oral micronized progesterone because of the GABA effect might have some benefit. Would you agree with that?
Yes. So there, that's where, like, if 100% of the women came to me saying, I have trouble sleeping, I would say 50% of them with the addition of hormone treatment, mostly progesterone, but also estrogen. Estrogen does play a role in how it can help regulate sleep, melatonin, some of these other pieces that are key for our sleep. But another half, still out of that 100%, only half were getting the sleep that they needed after hormone therapy.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's attributed to, again, whether or not they have the sort of the GABA effect from the micronized progesterone, or getting those night sweats under control that are not waking them up necessarily.
Or other things. So lots of other things that can affect sleep.
You mentioned melatonin. Do you mind talking about that for a minute? Because that feel like is like everyone's like, no, melatonin doesn't work for me. And I feel like it has a lot to do with what's available and how they're taking it. And yeah, maybe it doesn't work for everyone, even when they're optimized.
You are right. It is the kind and when you take it. So melatonin is released from our pineal gland about 4 hours before we actually fall asleep. It is released in picograms. It's sold in milligrams. It is sold as a sleep aid. It is a clock starter in our brain. So it doesn't really work the way that we think it is supposed to work in our body. Not only that, we have a reduction in melatonin production. By the time we're 50, it's pretty much reduced by almost 50%. So that, and melatonin is our circadian rhythm, our timing hormone that is used. GABA helps to induce relaxation. It really helps to calm the body and prepare it for sleep. So even though people are taking micronized progesterone that's helping to increase that GABA, if you have an issue with your circadian rhythm, your melatonin production, the timing, then you're still going to have issues with sleep. Not only that, but of the women who have sleep apnea, 9 out of 10 of those women do not know that they have it, because the symptoms are different in women than they are in men.
That's wonderful. Oh, before we talk about sleep apnea, what do you recommend for melatonin when?
Yeah.
But I do want to do the sleep apnea after.
Yeah. So for melatonin, there is some data coming out. We've always poo-pooed sustained release melatonin, but now there's some newer data coming out that a really tiny dose of sustained release melatonin taken a couple of hours before bed might in fact help you with your what we call sleep architecture. So that is achieving all of the stages of sleep and then increasing sleep efficiency. That is the total amount of sleep time that you're having in one night. So with that reduction of melatonin production in our body, I am now convinced that we should be taking a small dose of melatonin. So when I say small, I think of anywhere between 0.3 milligrams to 1 milligram of melatonin, sustained release, a couple of hours before we go to bed. Now, some people are very sensitive to it. That's why I have this range. But 1 milligram generally is going to be okay for most people. It's hard to find the 0.3. It's hard to find the 0.5. Now, having said that, there are studies that have been done that show that there's just, you know, we don't have any regulation of supplements. So we want to go with someone that we know is doing third-party testing that is tried and true. And you might, because a lot of the stuff that's sold over-the-counter when you go to like the major supermarkets, the studies show that it could be antihistamine, that it could be, it says on the bottle 3 milligrams, but it's really 8. And so we want to be careful.
There's no regulation
with melatonin, because if you take too much, then you start having problems. You have nightmares. It can make people have like a hangover effect the next day.
Yes.
So then you're not sure, am I tired because I'm not getting enough sleep, or am I tired because I'm taking too much melatonin? Or is there some other sleep issue going on?
Is there a third part? Is there a group or a company that you found to be, you know, significantly helpful for your patients? I know you don't usually recommend.
I know. Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, if there's something that you think has worked or and you've studied that they do third-party testing, is there one you like particularly?
Yeah, Pure Encapsulations. And I get, I have no affiliation with them, but they're actually made in Canada, and they do a really good job of their third-party testing. You know, Thorne Pharmaceuticals also. So some of those over, you can't find those in a drugstore. You have to buy them online. So yeah. Those, and they produce the lower doses. What's sold, I find, in supermarkets or at drugstores is that the doses are too high, and they're usually combined with other things. And so then you want to be careful. What are those other things that are combined? There's some things that I would say, yeah, but then if it's just loaded with a bunch of stuff, then you don't know what's working.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of like this unregulated sort of supplement industry, I always give the example because so many women turn to cannabis, you know, for sleep aids and other things. And I think I read a study like up to a fourth of women or a third of women would turn into cannabis to help them sleep in the midlife. And so I was, you know, it's just like when people say they don't feel anything when they take gummies, it's just as unregulated, right? You could take one that tastes like a gummy bear and the other one is like puts you out or makes you high and all the things. Is there one particularly cannabinoid that you would recommend or a cannabis?
Yeah, you know, cannabinoids, CBN, it has been shown to help increase your ability to get to sleep, but there isn't really good data that says that it is helping you get into all the right stages of sleep. And I still am not a fan of cannabinoids or cannabis to be used for sleep. At the end of the day, it is, it to me, it is similar to some of the other agents that are prescribed for sleep, where it gives you the perception that you're getting sleep, but you're not really getting the right kind of sleep, the right stages.
The right stages. Do you mind going over those stages for the listeners?
Okay, so there are three stages of sleep. There's, we call them N1, N2, and N3, and then there's REM sleep. So in total, four. So N1 is kind of that very light sleep. A lot of people will think that they were awake all night, but they were probably going between N1 and N2. N2 is what we actually get the most of in a night. N2 is that mid stage of sleep. And then N3 is what we call deep sleep or our deep stage of sleep. And that's when growth hormone is released. And we actually naturally reduce N3 levels as we age, which is part of kind of also how we age, because we're getting less N3, so we're getting less time to repair. So then as we age, we have reduction of N3, which makes sense. Then our cells, you know, more oxidative stress. And then REM sleep is when we're actually cleaning the products out of the waste products out of our brain. That is kind of when the washing machine for the brain turns on. And we absolutely need REM sleep to live. So a lot of people will say, well, I can never dream. I don't remember any of my dreams. The fact that you're sitting there talking to me tells me that you're dreaming, because we simply cannot survive if we're not getting REM sleep.
Right. No, absolutely. Do you, on another side note, because do you recommend any of these products, you know, like the ones that measure your sleep? Like, are there, do you think that any of them are reliably looked at in the literature in terms of like the Oura Ring or, you know, your Apple Watch and all the things?
I know. So those are called wearables. So the things I have a whole talk on wearables. I've got two on right now. This is one called the Eevee Ring. It's a little tiny startup company, but it's really made just for women. Of course, the Oura Ring is like the big brother to it. So the Oura Ring's been out for a really long time. It's got the most population data, but the data that is being used is really focused on general population. So women are then kind of lumped in. And, you know, women, and especially postmenopausal women, have different values. So what I would say to that is that wearables are great adjuncts to helping you identify patterns, but they are not diagnostic. So I tell people right now, first wake up and ask yourself how you feel.
Yeah.
Because these wearables tend to prime people. So in other words, you might feel like you slept really well, and then you look at your data and you say, oh my gosh, I didn't sleep well at all. Oh, I didn't sleep.
And then it gets in your
head, right? And the most accurate device on the market is likely the Oura Ring. We're right behind it, this Eevee Ring, because I sit on the board.
Yeah.
And that's at 75% accuracy. So Apple Watches are trying really hard to get there. Garmin, let's see, the Wahoo. I mean, there's so many. And then all the rings are the devices that are out there. Uh-huh. They're all, anything that you put on your body is called a wearable. Anything that you put beside you is called a nearable. And those are less accurate. So bottom line, they're great to help you identify something that might be abnormal, but they are not diagnostic tools. And I think that is really lost on the general public that we don't want to diagnose you with something that's only 75% correct.
Right. Right. And what world is that?
Right. Okay. Like you don't want to be diagnosed with a sleep disorder that is a fourth incorrect half the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, a fourth incorrect, a fourth of the time.
right. That the positive predictive value, all the sensitivity basically of the test is really not that great. Well, so that's really helpful, actually, because, people are always asking, which one should I get? And da-da-da. And so I'm always like, well, I don't even have the data on that. So that's very helpful. Okay, let's go back to what you were saying about obstructive sleep apnea.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that is something that we see a lot in our office. Most people probably see and don't even realize that, it's not the typical patient that you would think of, right, that might have it. Because women don't have, just like in cardiovascular disease, we don't always present with the typical symptoms. I interviewed Dr. Jane Morgan, and she was like, by calling them atypical, we're already othering it and making it harder for patients to get the right diagnosis because we're not making it a normal. This is normal for women.
Right.
Because we don't even have the good data to say this is normal for women, but we're delaying diagnosis and treatments and lives. But let's talk a bit about, what obstructive sleep apnea is and how do we diagnose it and how is it different in women?
Yeah. So obstructive sleep apnea, the one that everybody knows about is simple obstructive sleep apnea. People do not realize that there are many different phenotypes. So that word for the general public means that they're just different subtypes of sleep apnea. The one that everybody knows about, that hears about, that reads about online and social media is simple obstructive sleep apnea. That means that this part of the neck area where the tongue falls back and the soft tissues close together, it closes off too much, which then reduces oxygen saturation. And that is actually how you get diagnosed. It is not, yes, one of the symptoms is snoring. But when we take a look at a sleep study, I am looking at reductions of oxygen saturations for a certain amount of time. It's actually very technical. So people don't realize that I am looking at a lot of different what we call channels. Mm-hmm. We're looking at three channels of breathing. We're looking at multiple channels of brain activity. We're looking at movement. All of these things play a role into whether or not somebody has what we call an apnea. Then there are calculations that are made to determine how many times you're having apnea per hour. That's when we get the apnea hypopnea index. And five or more of those events is sleep apnea. And women tend to have REM-related sleep apnea, meaning that most of their abnormal breathing is happening when we're dreaming. So it's harder to capture. So just to your point about, let's not talk about atypical, let's just talk about how women present, right? Mm-hmm. So women will have more fragmentation of sleep. They might have more depressive symptoms. They rarely are told or come in saying that they have loud snoring. They will say that they toss and turn. They might wake up with some headaches. But it's again, not specific symptoms. And sometimes women will say, I just don't feel good when I wake up and I'm giving myself 7 hours of sleep and something just doesn't feel right.
Right.
So I have a lower threshold of testing women because we simply haven't developed great screening tools for them.
Absolutely.
Screening tools are gender biased.
Yes.
So we don't capture the women. Yeah. And we have the same heart attack and stroke risk as men do when we're postmenopausal.
Absolutely.
I was just going to say that is key. People need to realize that moderate or severe sleep apnea actually has an increased risk for heart attacks and strokes.
That's wonderful to say. And also, just any, can you talk a little bit about how abnormalities in your sleep cycle can, you know, affect metabolic function a little bit and or the amount you're sleeping?
Right. So when we think about if somebody is having to wake up all of the time because their brain wakes them up to breathe, if you have sleep apnea, that's one reason why people will have then a metabolic dysregulation, because everything, your body is this, how I explain it to patients is that all of your organs, it's like a metropolis, you know, it's a city, and yeah. Certain things have to open up and certain things have to close. And when you're going to sleep, the anchor stores are kind of sleeping. The anchor stores are like your heart, your lungs, your brain. Those big organs need to kind of get into sleep mode. And then all of these other little organs, the little boutiques, they're opening up. And if we are not getting into the right stages of sleep, then all of that hormonal balance becomes imbalanced. And so then that's why people have abnormal cortisol levels secondary to sleep, not the cortisol levels that we think about with other medical conditions, just it's a little off. Sometimes people have elevated blood counts. So the red blood cell level is elevated because your body is trying to make more red blood cells to carry oxygen. People will, you know, so those are the big ones that we talk about, that metabolically people will just have, everything will be off. Also, then all of the, you know, all of your other hormones that regulate blood sugar, that regulate sex, you know, hormones, your libido, all of these things get affected when you're not getting into the right stages of sleep.
Absolutely. That's great to hear. I mean, not great to hear, but that's great for you to say so that people will know. Okay. So you feel like you have a patient in front of you that you think, you know, I should test her for sleep apnea. So walk me through what a sleep test looks like for that patient.
So that's another thing that I think social media has not done sleep any favors. People really say, they'll come in and say, I think I need a home sleep study. It's kind of like saying, I think I need, you know, an MRI, right? You just don't really know. I need to make that assessment, right? So by and large, home sleep studies, particular home sleep studies, do a better job than others, especially when we're testing women. And again, that goes back to that REM-related sleep apnea. If you can't capture the REM sleep accurately, sometimes you can't capture the abnormal breathing. So home studies are a good first pass. There's a different type of home study that kind of acts like an in the sleep center sleep study that is called a type 2 home sleep study. And that can capture more of the stages of sleep. But sometimes women just simply need to be in the sleep center.
Yes.
That's where we actually look at all of the sleep stages the most comprehensively. It also has the most sensitivity for breathing abnormalities. And again, women fall into this category where they will have mild sleep apnea overall, but then these little clusters of significant abnormal breathing, and that is during REM sleep. And if you're sleeping in a weird place, or maybe you're not getting good sleep, sometimes we don't capture enough REM sleep. So then, you know, women are told, oh, well, you don't have sleep apnea with a home study.
Yeah.
And home studies have a higher false negative rate for women than they do for men. So it's complex. So a home study, you have to go back to, you know, what's the difference? A home study is where you have a few connections on your body, some key ones, which are measuring oxygen saturation, heart rate, sometimes heart rhythm, and maybe one electrode that's measuring your sleep stages. And then a type 2 has a couple of more additions for measuring oxygen and more sleep stages. And then an in the sleep center sleep study is the full meal
gold
deal.
Standard. Yeah. It's the gold standard, correct?
Yeah.
And what happens to a patient when they find, because I feel like when I send patients to sleep centers, sometimes it's hard for them to get appointments. There's long wait lists, you know, all the things. And then they finally get one, but they're very grateful that they actually got, because sometimes they'll get this diagnosed. Well, I didn't think I had obstructive sleep, you know? So tell me what a patient will experience when they come to a sleep center. How does that work?
Yeah. So I'm going to address that point that you just made, that people have a hard time getting. We don't have enough sleep doctors in the country, and we definitely don't have enough sleep doctors in the country that understand women's health. So a lot of women will go and be told that they don't need a study. Okay. So I'm actually in the process of opening up my private practice. I do live in the state of Oregon. I don't know if I'm going to, you know, acquire a license outside of the state, but I feel this calling and this need to open up a practice for women.
Yes.
So what they expect is, you know, you're going to sleep in this bed. You have a lot of attachments, and it is, there's a whole lot of little stickies on your head. There's something that's put in your nose that looks like it's giving you oxygen, but it's not. It's measuring pressure and temperature changes of the work of breathing. You have two like bungee cord style belts that are measuring the effort of breathing in your chest and abdomen, because we use that to help us sleep. Something that's measuring heart rate, heart rhythm, and oxygen saturations, and then attachments that are looking for movement in your legs and sometimes your arms.
Okay, gotcha.
It's a lot.
And then, yeah, it's a lot. And so you just have them sleep for the night.
Then you have them sleep for the night. And we, you know, I always laugh thinking, okay, now we've put you in this weird place. We have all these attachments. Now I need you to sleep at least 6 hours.
Yeah. It's kind of like when you make someone, you know, pee or ejaculate in a cup and they have all this performance and anxiety around.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is why home studies, generally speaking, are a good first pass, especially if you don't have other medical conditions that really indicate that you need to go into a sleep center first.
Yeah.
But I think it really it depends on the person interpreting. So sleep doctors are the only people that can interpret a sleep study. And we really need to kind of tailor how we want people to use the home study to capture the data that we really need, especially for women.
And so you have someone either in any of these studies that comes back and they have now general OSA. What would you, so what's the first line treatment for them? Because most people are really intimidated by the devices, you know?
Well, so CPAP, there are different types of what we call positive airway pressure. That's what the PAP stands for. CPAP stands for continuous positive airway pressure, but there are other types of positive airway pressure. So again, the one that everybody hears about is CPAP. And so then that's a mask. Yes, most masks are made for men's faces. So that's already barrier one for women. And then two, insurance companies typically will only cover one or two types of masks. So then, you know, you're kind of already set up to fail, because maybe one particular mask works really well for you, but your insurance doesn't cover it. So then you have to pay $100 for that mask.
Right.
So masks can come in many different forms. Some of them come just under the nose. Some of them are just right over the nose. Some of them are under the nose and over the mouth. Some of them are over the nose and over the mouth. But most often, I will have people just do the little one that's either under the nose or just a little tiny one that's over the nose. So CPAP is our first line of treatment because that's what we have the most data on. Okay.
Sure.
However, for women, if women have mild sleep apnea that's severe during REM sleep, they had some desaturations, but they did not have hypoventilation, meaning they didn't spend all this time with low oxygen, and we didn't see that they were having a hard time moving air. Sometimes an oral appliance, or what we call a mandibular advancement device, or oral apnea therapy. You know, there's many different ways to say it.
Sure.
Some of these devices work really well for women. The caveat is that you do have to spend some dollars, again, because insurance may only cover one type of oral appliance with your dentist.
Right.
There's over 17 on the market.
Okay.
Well, so it gets complex, right?
And, and very nuanced.
Yes, it's new. That's, I think, what I am trying to say loud and clear, that sleep is nuanced. It is not cut and dry.
Right. Just like menopausal care.
Yes. Yeah. So people will say, well, I just need an oral appliance. I'm just going to buy one online. No, please don't do that. Right. Because an oral appliance that you buy online is not fit for precision for your mouth. And you have to wake up in the morning and talk and eat and drink.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So important, actually. And I think that's one of the issues is that we're so used to just like going on Amazon and clicking and buying something that we don't have to like, you know. But the reality is most of what you're saying is so true that insurance is really, and I say this on many of my podcasts, that they set women up for failure when it comes to menopause, when it comes to sexual medicine and all the things, because the systems aren't really made for that. We don't have, you know, FDA approved products that are, you know, for women in a lot of these arenas, you know, especially like, in, you know, some of the postmenopausal low libido issues that we talk about. So I think these are, you know, some setups that systemically as a structure, as a medical structure, as a medical system that are really set up to fail women. And so you can't always just order something online and think it's going to cure you and make you sleep better.
100%. I would spend the dollars because the fact of the matter is now that if you want to get good care, your insurance typically isn't going to cover it for you anymore, right? So I would spend the dollars if you had sleep apnea and you saw someone who said it's simple obstructive sleep apnea, I would probably get an oral appliance and see a dentist who understands sleep apnea and then get fitted for the right type of oral appliance that you can use. You know, I think that that's probably the way to go for most women. The other thing that we haven't even touched on, and that's a whole nother topic, is that some women will have upper airway resistance syndrome. So that is again, that phenotype of sleep apnea. That's not even recognized as a treatable disease for insurance companies. And who gets that? Who gets upper airway resistance syndrome?
Women. Yes. Yeah. That's so frustrating.
Treatment for insomnia, because we haven't talked about that yet, is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Yes. That is the number one treatment. Yes. Okay. Typically not approved for treatment by most insurance companies, or there's one person that you can see and you have a 9-month waiting list. And who disproportionately gets insomnia, chronic insomnia?
Women. Mm-hmm. It's so frustrating, actually. And then, you know, most people want the quick fix. Like, I feel like I take care of a lot of patients. And as physicians and as a former obstetrician, you know, there are times you work a bunch of nights in a row and you get insomnia. And like, I feel like my sleep debt from residency is so huge that like you just never, you know, and I remember these periods of time where I just, you know, you couldn't sleep. And then the thought of not being able to sleep made you more anxious about not sleeping. And it became a really circular thing. Can we talk a little bit about insomnia before, you know, we wrap things up?
Yeah. So going back to that whole discussion where we were talking about hormone treatment and that in my world, I would start women on hormone therapy. We'd get to a good place for reducing most of their symptoms, but they were still having trouble sleeping. Mm-hmm. So then I evaluate them. I have this actual method that I developed called the dream sleep method, which goes over each component, right? And if we exhaust all of that, you don't have any other medical condition outside of chronic insomnia, then cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is the way to go. And that is retraining your brain. And I always tell people that is a marathon, that is not a 5K. Right. So, however, if we talk to people about the rest of their life, right? So it's maybe 3 to 4 months of hard work, uncomfortable work to set yourself up for the next decades of better sleep. And people come to me and they'll say, well, I don't want to do cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. I tried it. It doesn't work. You have to do every component of it for it to be successful. And the other piece is that people will come to me and I'll say, but you haven't been sleeping well for 10 years. So 3 months to 4 months of being uncomfortable so that you can set yourself up for the rest of your life of getting better sleep is a small price to pay, because what's happening right now isn't working.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you talk a little bit about the apps that say they do the CBTI, like how, you know, helpful do you think those are?
You know, they vary. So what happens with those apps is that people end up picking and choosing what they want to do. Mm-hmm. With the cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And it's not focused at the very beginning that you need to actually follow all of the components of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Mm-hmm. It's similar to, you know, I'll tell people, if you have high blood pressure, do you take your blood pressure medication 3 times a week?
Yeah.
No. Right? It's the same for like treating sleep apnea. People will say, well, I use my CPAP machine 4 times a week. I'm like, well, do you take your diabetic medication 4 times a week or do you take it every day?
Exactly.
So with cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, those apps, if you are all in and you focus on doing everything, it's going to be successful. Right.
I think that's the big issue, is really, you know, that dedication, because it's similar to anxiety and some of these other things where you have these ruminations and you have to actually face. And, you know, we talk about this in pelvic floor issues and like vaginismus and some of these conditions where you have to desensitize your brain. You have to reshape it. You have to restructure and reconfigure, you know, everything so that you don't continue in the same sort of loophole. And I think that so many patients don't, it brings them so much anxiety to face all of those things at once that they run from it. Right. And so it's only until they almost hit rock bottom that they're like, okay, fine, I'll do the dilators. I'll do the sex therapy. I'll do the cognitive behavioral therapy. Because most people want a quick fix with the medication, which doesn't always work.
Yes. So with sleep, there's no quick fix. Sleep is sleepy. That's what I like to say.
You have so many choices. And,
yeah. But if you, you know, I'm here for people, for if you want to start that journey, I am there to walk it with you. And I can guarantee that if we work together and we follow the tried and true methods, and we also think outside of the box too, like I will say, it's a all hands on deck approach. Yeah. Not one thing. There's not one silver bullet that's going to work. Mm-hmm.
That's like most of what we're doing these days. Can you just touch a little bit on the medications that are supposedly FDA approved for sleep, and then, you know, why they can be so dangerous for some patients?
Yes. So the medications that are FDA approved for sleep are really FDA approved for acute insomnia. Mm-hmm. So acute insomnia is when somebody has a really defined period of time that is affecting their sleep. You are getting a divorce. Someone dies. You move to a different part of the world, or you have a new job. And they're really, the fine print of all of those medications say not to use for more than 2 weeks at a time.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm racing it.
So they're not generally habit forming. It's more of the notion that you need it to get to sleep, but they don't really, the data is pretty weak on them. They're not really increasing hours of sleep. The best is it increases it by like 40 minutes.
That's not much.
So it's, and then most people who have chronic insomnia need an escalating dose, because the power of the brain overrides what any medication you're going to take. And that's the key with cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, is it's reframing and addressing the neurological pathway. Whereas medication is filling receptors, but if you have a hypervigilance, it doesn't matter how much medicine you take, you're not going to get to sleep.
Can you walk through the best forms of sleep hygiene? Like what you recommend for patients?
Sure.
I mean, we're all addicted to our little phone in front of us. And so I'm always like, you know, we got to, and you don't take your advice sometimes when it comes to that stuff.
I don't take my own advice. I get it. Yeah. It's pretty.
I'm always like, oh, okay. I don't know why I can't sleep, but.
I know it's kind of getting back to the basics. And, you know, so my general, plan for sleep hygiene, or that's how do I prepare myself for sleep, is wind down. Like, give yourself that hour before you want to go to sleep to start winding down. All the sensory, all the light in our life is not good for us. So yeah, put your phone down an hour before you're going to sleep. Don't put it in your bedroom. People will say, but I use it as my alarm clock. Okay, put it across the room. You can hear it. It's loud. If you need it right next to you, put it in the drawer of your nightstand. Just don't use it an hour before you go to sleep. We have nerve cells in our eye that connect directly to our wake center in our brain. we have too much light in our life. So it's not allowing us to actually shut down. So that's the biggest piece. The other piece is, you know, watch your caffeine intake. Caffeine's half-life is 5 to 7 hours. That means 50% of caffeine is still in your body after 5 to 7 hours. So studies have shown that if you drink caffeine too close to bedtime, it actually reduces your total sleep time by at least 30 minutes.
Mm.
Okay. You know, your bedroom should be dark, cool, and quiet. I'm a big proponent of eye masks, like reduce the sensory component. Uh-huh. If you need earplugs, I recommend earplugs. If you need blackout shades, you know, don't let that light in come in too early, because then you will have a hard time getting back to sleep. But generally speaking, you know, wear comfortable clothes, have a routine. My analogy is, when we're hungry, we don't just go, open the refrigerator and then start shoveling food in our mouth, right? We prepare ourselves to eat by preparing a meal or going to a restaurant, sitting down, relaxing, looking at the food in front of us, being mindful about our food intake. It's the same with sleep. We have to be mindful about how we prepare ourselves for sleep. And most people will say things like, oh, you know, I can drink caffeine until, you know, 30 minutes before I go to sleep, and then I fall right to sleep. And I will tell people, oh, that's just confirmation that you're chronically sleep deprived. Because again, it is a drug, so to speak, and your brain is overriding it because you're so tired.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. What about exercise? Some people swear that they exercise late in the day, they're good. And other people are like, oh, I can't exercise past this
point. Yeah, we used to not recommend heavy exercise at night. But there is a subset of people that will say that heavy exercise helps them feel sleepy. So I also tell people, you know yourself the best. If you know that exercise keeps you awake, like for me, it does. I really cannot exercise after a certain hour. then please don't do it at night, right? If you are the person who I exercise and then I feel super relaxed, hey, then do it at night.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, this has been so great, Andrea. Like, I feel like, you know, these are some of the basic questions that people are always like trying to, you know, navigate when it comes to sleep. And we know how important sleep is. Everyone is obsessed with their sleep patterns. When looking for someone to help, you know, navigate their sleep disruptions, like, are there sources for finding a good therapist? I see for that does CBTI. Are there resources for, you know, other sleep doctors like yourself?
You know, so I know that there are sleep doctors all over the country, right? About a third of sleep doctors are women. I would say that you want to focus on somebody who isn't only looking at sleep apnea, but is looking at the entire picture, because I think that there has been this tendency for sleep doctors to really only focus on sleep apnea. And that's not really going to, up to 60% of people who have sleep apnea have insomnia. There's actually a name for it. It's called COMISA. So, you want a holistic approach to your sleep. So that's the first thing. So in most big cities, you're going to have some sleep doctors, right? Now, if you're looking for somebody to really focus on insomnia, you really want them to be trained in cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Because time and time again, I've had many people come to me over the years and tell me that they saw a psychologist who helped them with sleep, and they only focused on sleep hygiene, getting ready for bed. That's not it. It's really about understanding the hyperarousal, hypervigilance in your sleep that is preventing you from staying asleep or getting to sleep.
Oh, that's good. Okay. Is there like any, like, you know how you can go to the Menopause Society and find a sort of menopause practitioner?
So the American Academy of Sleep Medicine does have a list of sleep clinicians. The American Psychological Association has a list of cognitive behavioral therapy trained for insomnia trained. So you want to just make sure that you search for that. that I the person is CBTI trained. And that there's a book, actually. Again, I have no affiliation. It's just I often will say to people, this is the best like $40 you're going to spend. It is called Overcoming Insomnia, A Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Approach. It's a workbook, and it really takes you through the steps for self-help. Sometimes I think getting the book over an app helps people. It's little, it's thin, it's not very big. It's totally doable. And it is a game changer if you actually, you know, follow it 100%.
Oh, that's great. That's great to hear. Well, we love to have those resources. So we'll put them into our discussion notes in this podcast as well. But thank you so much, Andrea. This has been great. You know, like sleep is so important for so many people and your knowledge is amazing. And I feel like, you know, more people should follow you and everything that you're talking about on all of your platforms. And, you know, we'd love to hear about your practice. Are you in the process of evolving into a practice? Or
Yes. So I'm in the process of developing my own private practice. You can also follow me on Instagram, Sleep Goddess MD. I have a website as well. And I do have a fair amount of blogs on my website that focus on sleep in general, but then also sleep and menopause.
Wonderful. Well, we'll keep up with that. So anyone in the area that wants to come see you as a patient, they'll be able to. And if you ever expand beyond that, I'm sure we'll find out from your website.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today on Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman. Remember, I'm here to educate so you could advocate for yourself. Please join me on next week's episode. If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.